From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman. This week he receives his third Pulitzer Prize for his post-September 11th columns commenting on the worldwide impact of the terrorist threat. Friedman's previous Pulitzers were for his reporting from Lebanon and Israel. Recently, Friedman became part of the story when he helped convince Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia to make public his Middle East peace proposal. Tom Friedman, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI says it's reorganizing in order to better prepare for potential terrorist attacks. NPR's Beth Fertig has more.
In announcing the changes, Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller acknowledged the FBI failed to adapt quickly enough after the September 11th attacks. The agency's reorganization plan includes a new Office of Intelligence and more oversight of counterterror investigations. The FBI will overhaul its outdated computer systems and hire 900 new agents by September, including experts in computers and foreign languages, and the agency will cooperate more with the CIA. Mueller said he was embarrassed by allegations that the FBI failed to respond to the concerns of its field agents before September 11th. These included warnings from the Phoenix office about Middle Eastern men taking flying lessons and a complaint from a Minneapolis agent that the FBI hindered efforts to obtain a search warrant for terror suspect Zakaria Moussaoui. Beth Fertig, NPR News, Washington.
Vice President Dick Cheney's former company announced today that federal regulators are investigating its accounting practices. Halliburton Company, an oil field services company based in Dallas, said it expects to receive a formal request for documents or a subpoena from the Securities and Exchange Commission in the next few days. The announcement followed a New York Times article last week, which alleged the company reported money owed it by some of its engineering and construction clients as revenue, even though the amounts of money involved were in dispute. The accounting practice, which boosted Halliburton's revenues by millions of dollars, was adopted when Vice President Cheney was Halliburton's chief executive. Secretary of State Colin Powell says a reported offer by Libya to pay compensation to the families of those killed in the 1988 bombing of Pan Am 103 sounds like a step in the right direction, but Powell cautioned that such an offer would not resolve all problems with respect to Libya. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The New York law firm says the money would be put in escrow and paid out when the United Nations and United States lifted sanctions against Libya and the U.S. took Libya off its state sponsors of terrorism list. But details are sketchy, and at least one report from Tripoli indicates the offer might not have government support in Libya. Reporters asked Secretary of State Colin Powell about it at the State Department.
Well, we're waiting to see what the actual Libyan offer is. It's not yet formally put on the table, and we'll examine it when we see all of its elements.
Powell said such an offer would be a step in the right direction, but he said it would not resolve all U.S. issues with respect to Libya. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 58 points to close at 9,923 in moderate trading of just over a billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 27 points. This is NPR News. British troops have been assigned to guard Afghanistan's border with Pakistan in an effort to keep al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters from slipping back into the country. Officials are concerned that al-Qaeda and the Taliban might try to disrupt the Grand Council that will meet in June to establish a new government. A British spokesman said about 300 British troops have been sent to the area over the past several days, but the number could rise to around 700. A new study called Driving While Female suggests a nationwide problem involving some police officers who are abusing their powers with women drivers. Carolyn Johnson reports from Nebraska Public Radio.
University of Nebraska criminal justice professor Samuel Walker, the lead author of the study, found 400 allegations of abuse from 1990 to 2001. Each year, about 12 were substantiated. For example, a Chicago police officer fondled women during traffic stops. In Denver, a police officer raped a female motorist in his patrol car. A deputy sheriff in Florida tricked four women into exposing their breasts during traffic stops. Walker says police departments need to do a better job of supervising officers, maintain an open system for citizens to file complaints, investigate complaints, and hire and promote more women. For NPR News, I'm Carolyn Johnson in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The Bush administration is calling for more transparency from the big mortgage finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The White House wants the two companies to be required to publicly disclose the same information as companies that are supervised by the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's asked a Federal Office of Housing Enterprise Oversight to come up with new rules. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy Brandeis O'Flavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tom Friedman will receive his third Pulitzer Prize tomorrow at a luncheon ceremony on the Columbia University campus. Friedman writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. He will be awarded the Pulitzer Prize for distinguished commentary for his clarity of vision based on extensive reporting in commenting on the worldwide impact of the terrorist threat. Friedman used to cover the Middle East for the Times. His first two Pulitzers were for his reporting from Lebanon and Israel. His best-selling book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, won a National Book Award. This summer, he'll have a new book out called Longitudes and Attitudes that will collect his post-September 11th columns, along with journal excerpts covering his travels around the world. Tom Friedman, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your third Pulitzer Prize.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Now, let's acknowledge the fact that you've become part of one of the stories. On February 17th, you wrote a column about your meeting with Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, in which you proposed that if Israel withdrew to pre-1967 lines and the Palestinian state was established, then the Arab League nations would offer Israel full diplomatic relations, normalized trade, and security guarantees. And what did the prince say to your proposal?
Well, he said that he had been thinking about the same thing, that he'd actually drafted a speech along those lines, which he was planning to deliver to the Arab League summit. But in light of what he said Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister, had been doing in the West Bank, he decided not to give that speech. But he claimed that I had broken into his drawer and read the speech, tongue-in-cheek, he claimed, because his ideas so tracked my own.
So did you convince the prince to actually make that plan public?
Yes.
What did you say?
I basically said that I was flattered to know that his ideas tracked mine. That was all very nice, well and good. But unless he put them on, we were having an off-the-record conversation, I should say. This was in a dinner at his home. But unless he put them on the record, they really wouldn't mean anything. And that I'd heard that excuse so many times in the past, from Arab leaders, if only Bibi Netanyahu hadn't done this, I was about to go to Israel. You know, if only Sharon hadn't done this, I was about to, make peace with Israel. I said none of that really mattered until and unless he put it on the record in his own name, in his own voice, in Arabic, in ways that would be read not only by Israelis but by his own people. And he thought about that. He said he wanted to think about it, and he thought about it for over 24 hours before he came back and agreed to put it on the record.
So do you consider that proposal, which was discussed at the Arab League meeting and which has been—
Discussed in past, actually.
Yeah. Is it still in play? Does it mean anything right now, given the deteriorating state of relations between Israel and the Palestinians?
No, that's a very good question, Terry. I think it does, actually, and I think it does for several reasons. Let's go back and let's ask, if I might rephrase your question, was it just PR? Because that's really, one of the questions that that many people asked afterwards. And my first answer to that is, of course, it was PR. It was designed, and maybe first and foremost, to improve Saudi Arabia's terrible image in the United States after 9/11, in light of the fact that 15 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. But the real, to me, the more important question is, was it only PR? And I believe categorically it was not only PR. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia understood several things. He understands that he's now living in a different age. Something very big is happening out there, Terry. Three historical forces are converging right now in the Middle East. One is the worst interpersonal fighting between Israelis and Palestinians that we've seen in the history of this conflict in many ways. That's going on, you know, over there in Palestine on stage. On another historical track, you're having a population explosion. There's a huge population cohort of young Arabs and Muslims that are kind of marching toward the workplace right now. 40% of Saudi Arabia is under the age of 14. 75% of Saudi Arabia is under the age of 29. So think of all of them as just a big army of young men and women marching toward a workplace where, frankly, there are not a lot of jobs and certainly not enough good jobs to go around. That's happening on a second track. On a third track, what is happening is an explosion of Arab multimedia, primarily independent satellite TV stations out of the control of governments and the internet. And basically what is happening in simple terms is that explosion of Arab multimedia is taking the images of this terrible intifada of fighting between Israelis and Palestinians and feeding it to this new generation, this population explosion coming of age. Now, not only is that, I believe, a huge threat to Israel, but I think it is perceived by the Arab leaders as really being a threat to them. There's been a lot of talk about the Arab street rising up. Well, I don't think this street is going to rise up, but it has clearly inflamed passions of many of these young people in ways that I've never seen before. And these inflamed passions are meeting up with other discontents, discontents about their own lacking economic opportunities and discontent about their own dictatorial government. And it's creating an incredible, at a minimum, foul wind out in that part of the world. And this foul wind is an extremely anti-American wind. And if it persists, what's going to happen is it's going to become increasingly difficult for these pro-American regimes like the Saudi regime, like the Egyptian regime, to maintain the kind of relationship they want and believe they need for their own survival. And so for all these reasons, I believe that Crown Prince Abdullah and other Arab leaders, who I think have shamelessly exploited the Palestinian-Israeli conflict over the years as a way of diverting their people's attention from domestic issues, have come to understand that they really now have an interest in, at a minimum, taking this show off the air. And I believe that's a lot of what was behind the Saudi initiative.
You say that you're seeing, as a result of all the mass, the new independent mass media, you're seeing discontents you didn't see before in younger people in the Arab world. Give us a sense of things you're seeing now that seem new to you.
Well, I guess the newest thing is the number of young Arabs, particularly Arab women, Muslim women, who have emailed me since 9/11 to simply tell me how frustrated they are and to keep up my criticism on issues like democratization, like education reform, like economic reform. You know, the great frustration of the Arab world, I believe, is that unlike other regions of the world, it's really only been able to ask one question for 50 years: who controls Palestine? Think about it for a second. China is as obsessed with Taiwan. It's as neuralgic an issue for the Chinese as Palestine is for the Arab and Muslim world. Yet China has managed to ask more than one question of itself and of its people: who controls Taiwan? As big as that issue is, it's also been able to ask the question: how do we reform and update our education system? How do we reform and develop our economy? How do we pluralize our politics? In the Arab world, that has not happened. Basically, Arab politics and intellectual thought, political intellectual thought, has been dominated by one question, and one question only: who controls Palestine? And anyone who wants to raise the issue of what about who controls us? What about political reform? What about economic reform? What about how do we plug into the world? What about education reform? All those questions have been drowned out by this other larger question of who controls Palestine.
Why do you think that is? Because for people who aren't living in the West Bank or Gaza, the issue of education in their country, of democracy in their country, of the economy in their country, jobs in their country, is of much more day-to-day importance. you know, just in terms of the quality of their life?
I think there's a couple of reasons for it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. One short answer is culture. There is something about the culture there that is different from the culture of Asia. And I can't tell you what it is, but I do believe culture matters and explains a lot of things. The other is deliberate politics. I mean, you see, there are different bargains struck. If you look at the bargain that East Asian leaders struck with their people, this is very crude shorthand, but it actually works. The East Asian leaders basically came to their people 50 years ago and said, if you give up democracy, we will give you prosperity. And their people gave up democracy, and in the end, they got prosperity. And when they got enough prosperity, they also got democracy. In the Middle East, Arab leaders came to their people and said, if you give up democracy, we will give you the Arab-Israeli conflict. And that's what they've given them for 50 years. And I believe it's been a huge diversion and crutch that these leaders have used to mask not only their own incredible failures to modernize and develop their countries, but to divert their people's energies and attention away from them and the whole idea of pluralizing power and politics. And don't get me wrong, I respect and appreciate why the olive tree issue, who controls Palestine, would resonate and be important to young Arabs and Muslims. But you got to ask more than one question, and they haven't. And they've paid a huge price for that, I believe, as a society.
What was it like for you to be part of the story? You know, what are some of the repercussions of having been part of the reason why the Saudi prince made his peace proposal public at the Arab summit?
Well, you know, believe it or not, Terry, I really wasn't thinking about it that much. The sequence of events was the following. I wrote a column proposing that at their summit they make a proposal to Israel calling for full peace and normalization and trade for all 22 members of the Arab League in return for full Israeli withdrawal. So full peace from the Arab League for full Israeli withdrawal. Because it seemed to me, why did I think that was an important idea? Because it was clear to me there was an Israeli peace plan on the table, the Barak plan, even if the current Israeli government hadn't embraced it. There was a clear Israeli peace plan on the table. There was an American peace plan on the table, the Clinton peace plan. Even if the Bush administration hadn't embraced it, it was on the table. And what was missing was an Arab peace plan. There was no Arab peace plan. An Arab peace plan in the sense of not only stipulating what the Arabs wanted from Israel, but doing something they really hadn't done as a collective, and that was to stipulate what they would be ready to give Israel in return as a community, as all 22 members of the Arab League. And I felt that if there were such a thing on the table, that it might begin to catalyze the situation. So I wrote that column. Did Crown Prince Abdullah read that column and just copy it and claim that it was his idea? Honestly, Terry, I have no idea, and I have no way of knowing what was really in his drawer. I didn't go into his office and look. But the truth is, I really wasn't thinking about it. When he said it, I thought it was important. I thought it was important that he say it in his own voice. And when he did, I did what seemed to me any self-respecting columnist would do. I put it on the record. Now, I know that no one in Washington, no pundits here, have ever been the vehicle or platform for floating an idea from a government official or a member of Congress. And at the same time, I know that things were going so well between Israelis and Palestinians. I'm so sorry I got in the way with a little ray of sunlight. But you know what? Up your nose with a rubber hose. If I can make some little, you know, ray of sunlight by bringing this guy's words to the public, I'm going to do it. And guess what? I then stepped out of the way because it all depended, as I told everybody, what he did with those words. And what he did with those words was go to the Arab League and make them the official policy of the Arab League. And even though they were slightly watered down, they are now the official policy of the Arab League. We will get back to a new peace process eventually. I really firmly believe that. And when we do, I won't be surprised if the Abdullah Initiative is actually the platform on which the next round of peacemaking is built.
My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. Tomorrow he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. It's for his post-September 11th columns. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is my guest. He is a political columnist for the New York Times. Tomorrow he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. Now, in your columns, you have been critical of both Israelis and Palestinians. For example, you say that Sharon wants two Israeli states and that Arafat really wants two Palestinian states. Explain what you mean there.
Well, you know, I believe Yasser Arafat has been negotiating all these years for a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. But at the same time, by his demand for the right of return of the refugees from 1948 to pre-1967 Israel, not the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, but Tel Aviv, Haifa, and the Galilee, he also wants a Palestinian state there as well. The first one he wants to get through negotiations. The second he wants to get through population transfer and demographics. And Yasser Arafat never, ever quite closes the door and throws away the key on the thought that there would be a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and also that one day that they would recover all of the rest of Palestine. Ariel Sharon is just the reverse. He wants an Israeli state in the area pre-1967 Israel, in Tel Aviv, Haifa, the Galilee, and the Negev. And at the same time, by his furious building of settlements all over the West Bank to make it impossible for Israel to ever get out of those areas, he wants a Jewish state in the West Bank, at Gaza, and East Jerusalem as well. And so, you know, poor little stupid me, I just signed up for two states. And but it turns out these guys have actually been struggling for four, two apiece. And I think until we get back to just fighting over two states, we're really, I think, not going to get anywhere.
So let me ask you how you would resolve these issues. Let's start with the right of return. You're arguing the right of return would make Israel into a Palestinian state because so many Palestinians would move there.
I would deal with that is you know, it's very simple, to, you know, that Palestinians will live in the Palestinian state and Jews will live in the Jewish state. And that means, very simply, the Palestinians have to abandon the right of return to pre-1967 Israel, and the Jews have to abandon the right of return to post-1967 Israel, i.e. the West Bank and Gaza. And that's the obvious and natural trade-off here. And if Palestinians are only going to feel home if they're back in their exact home, you know, that their grand or great-grandparents left in 1947 or 48, then I would really have to question, you know, what this is all about. Because, I mean, do you want a state that is the springboard and the foundation for the revival of your culture, your language, your history? Are you really not part of a community, and the only thing that will make you happy is if you're back in the exact house you left? If that's the case, I don't think history can help you.
Well, do you think that the Palestinians should get any form of compensation for the homes that they lost?
I think the issue of compensation is interesting. I certainly would support it. But I think there's also the issue of compensation for Jews who left their homes or were evicted from their homes in all these Arab countries between 1948 and 1967. And so, you know, I think the issue of compensation is a tricky one, but I personally believe and would like to see, and this was the idea in the Clinton plan, that Palestinians be given a choice, that those who want to return to the new Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, hopefully, should be able to do so, and I think should be facilitated in doing so with financial help for housing and for transfer. And those who have taken root somewhere else and simply don't want to move should be given the option, I believe, of financial compensation.
Who would supply the financial compensation?
I think the financial compensation should be provided by the EU, by the Arab world, by the United States, and by Japan. I think the normal collection of donors that have lined up to help places like Bosnia and Kosovo. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I could just follow up your question briefly, Terry, because I think another issue that I've tried to wrestle with was, well, how do you get to this point where these guys give up fighting for four states and get it down to just fighting for two states, one Palestinian state and next to a one Jewish Israeli state? And my answer to that is very simple, which is that without a civil war within each community, you will never solve the civil war between the two communities. And what I mean by that is simply that Palestinians, I believe the majority of Palestinians would be content with a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. I believe there's a minority, I can't tell you how big or small, that really wants to fight for the whole ball of wax, really does want to eliminate the Jewish state. Until and unless Yasser Arafat, or whoever is the Palestinian authority, crushes that movement, that dissident minority movement, and disarms them, and turns them into nothing more than a minority political party, or no party at all. In other words, until there is a civil war within the Palestinian community over this issue, and the majority that is content with simply one Palestinian state, now and forever, is dominant, you'll never resolve the issue.
What about in Israel? Yeah.
I said, ditto on the Israeli side. Until and unless you have a government in Israel ready to take on the settlers, to forcibly evict them if need be, and hopefully, much preferably, induce them, either financially or politically, to leave in the context of a peace agreement, until you have that civil war among the Jews, okay, you're not going to get anywhere either. So unless you have civil wars within the communities, you're never going to be able to resolve the larger civil war between the communities. And what so much of the peace process has been about ever since Anwar Sadat and Yitzhak Rabin were assassinated was each community trying to kind of get what it wanted and avoid that inevitable civil war. And I can't blame the leaders, because the leaders are terrified that they, if they take this large historic decision, will meet the fate of Yitzhak Rabin and Anwar Sadat.
Tom Friedman is a foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. Tomorrow, he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. We'll talk more on the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at vermontvacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what the Middle East might look like after Arafat and Sharon. We continue our conversation with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman. Tomorrow, he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Thomas Friedman. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. Tomorrow he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. It's for his post-September 11th columns. His previous Pulitzers were for his reporting for the Times from Lebanon and Israel. He won a National Book Award for his bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. This summer he'll have a new book called Longitudes and Attitudes that will collect his post-September 11th columns and include his journals of his travels after 9/11. When we left off, we were talking about the Middle East. He told me what effect he thinks this second intifada is having on the Palestinian cause.
I believe this Al-Aqsa intifada, this Palestinian uprising, was a huge strategic error for the Palestinians. I believe it never had a clear-cut strategy. And because of that, I believe it's done enormous damage to the Palestinian cause for one very simple reason. You know, when you had war in the Middle East, you could hope for peace. And when you had peace, you could hope for more peace. But when you get war after peace, in other words, war after Oslo, you really erode, so much of the confidence that you need for a peace deal between two intertwined communities. And I have a very, very simple, mantra here. The only people who can or will deliver the Palestinians a state of their own in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and the people, I believe, who under the right conditions would deliver the Palestinians a state of their own in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, is the Israeli center, the Israeli silent majority. And when they were challenged by Anwar Sadat, they delivered full Israeli withdrawal from the Sinai. When they were challenged, but with an outreached hand by King Hussein, they delivered the peace deal with Jordan, including land swaps. Until and unless the Palestinians pursue a strategy that is aimed at convincing the Israeli silent majority that they are content with one state and that they truly are ready to live side by side with a Jewish state within secure and recognized boundaries, the Palestinians are not going to get anywhere. And the suicide bombing, the whole intifada, I believe, has been an incredibly wasted. The intifada made sense for about 2 weeks, Terry. It made sense for the first 2 weeks for Yasser Arafat to signal, I can't accept the exact deal Clinton is offering me. I've got my own constituency here. I've got my own opposition. I could understand it for 2 weeks, maybe a month. It has made no sense for this length of time, and I believe it has set back the Palestinians enormously, and I think it's a real tragedy.
Let me ask you about a paradox that you describe in one of your columns, and that is that you say Israel can't remain a democracy as long as it remains an occupying force. But on the other hand, the Palestinians can't be trusted now to run the territories without making them a base of operations to fight against Israel. So what's your proposal?
What's the way around? Have you talked to Conference Abdullah about that, smart guy?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Basically the way I see it, Terry, is that the dilemma that faces us right now is that Israel cannot stay in the territories. It cannot stay in the territories and I believe remain in the long term a viable Jewish and democratic state. I also believe it can't leave the territories, just pick up and leave, because I believe if it did, there's every chance that those areas would be used by a minority of Palestinians to continue to pursue the struggle against Israel. And so what do you do? What do you do when you can't stay, but you also can't leave? And that, I believe, is the core of the diplomatic conundrum we have now. Now, we tried one approach. One approach was kind of leaving Israelis and Palestinians to work out an arrangement through Oslo of gradual authority given to Yasser Arafat over time to build a proto-state. And that didn't work. Oslo collapsed. It collapsed for two fundamental reasons. One, because Yasser Arafat built peace with one hand, and he continued to build hate against Jews and Israel in his mosque and his textbooks with the other. It failed also because Israel built peace with one hand, and it continued to build settlements that maintained a colonial occupation and seized Palestinian land with the other. And so that's basically why Oslo failed. So now we have to step back and say, well, how do we salvage this situation? And what I have suggested is I believe NATO should take over the West Bank. It should take over the West Bank the way it took over Bosnia and Kosovo in conjunction with, in negotiation with an understanding with both Israelis and Palestinians that What we need right now are two things. An arrangement that gets Israel out of the territories, but an arrangement that gets Israel out of the territories without exposing Israel to Palestinians having those territories as an independent base of operation if Israel is not there. And I think the only way to do that is with a credible third party. I would prefer U.S. troops, but if necessary, NATO troops, to take over, to really create a U.N. protectorate, a new mandate for Palestine under NATO and the U.N. that would have as its clear objective the creation of an independent Palestinian state, but would do so in a phased way that basically begins with new elections, the creation of a new Palestinian authority, and really gives the Palestinians a chance that they haven't had up to now, and challenges them with something they haven't been challenged with up to now, is gradual Israeli withdrawal on one hand, and the gradual development of real institutions and a civil society and a real Arab democracy with the other, all under the supervision and authority of a NATO-UN mandate.
Now, I want to get back to something you were saying before. You were saying that you think the Intifada has been very counterproductive for the Palestinians, that you could understand, say, a two-week-long second Intifada, but after 2 weeks or a month, it became a setback. What about Israel's incursions into the territories? Do you think that that's been a setback, too? Israel went back into the territories this week. Let me say their stated reason is to try to stop the suicide bombings, and the suicide bombings are after a period in which there weren't any, they're happening again in Israel.
Right. Well, here's basically what I think, Tara. I think that over the last 3 months, because of the success that the suicide bombings had in certainly unnerving Israelis, a fantasy was taking root among Palestinians and to some extent in the wider Arab world, a fantasy that was basically being fanned by Hezbollah and Hezbollah TV in Lebanon. And the fantasy was that you Palestinians, you don't need to make a peace deal with the Jews. You can drive them out not only of the West Bank, but maybe of Israel proper, just the way we drove them out of southern Lebanon. If you're ready to sacrifice enough, including your own children. That fantasy was taking root. See, the Hezbollah view of Israel is Israel's just a big, dumb Silicon Valley where everyone wants to drive a BMW and is only worried about their stock options. And therefore, if you come at them in a really vicious way, including by sacrificing your kids through suicide, you can actually drive the Jews out. I believe that was a huge fantasy. I believe that North Tel Aviv is not South Lebanon. And I believe that fantasy, that certainly people in the Israeli military establishment believed, that it had to be punctured. And the only way to puncture it was with the kind of fighting you saw during the last month. But I only supported this military operation that Israel did, or it only seemed to make sense to me under one condition, Terry, if it was meant to make the West Bank safe for Israel to leave permanently, not to stay permanently. And what worries me very much is that what Ariel Sharon is up to through this military operation is not just to puncture a fantasy so that we can get back to reality and negotiate a real peace agreement, one that will lead to a two-state solution. I believe Ariel Sharon wants to make the West Bank safe for Israel to stay, not for Israel to leave. So in that sense, if that is the objective, I think it will truly, truly be a huge failure.
My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. Tomorrow he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. It's for his post-September 11th columns. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is my guest. He's a foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. He's about to get his third Pulitzer Prize at a luncheon tomorrow. His first two were for his Middle East coverage. His new one is for his post-September 11th columns. He also won a National Book Award for his book, From Beirut to Jerusalem. There's a debate in Israel. There's a debate in the Bush administration now about whether to keep recognizing Arafat as the leader of the Palestinian Authority or force him out. And I think that debate, it's very interesting that that debate is happening in the Bush administration now. Say for argument's sake, Arafat was forced out by Israel or by Israel with the implicit backing of the Bush administration. Who are the other possible Palestinian leaders that could take his place?
Well, you know, my view of this is, and I'm agnostic on whether Arafat comes or goes. To me, it's a question of who's ready to make, you know, what decision. I believe if there are any justice in the world, Arafat, given the tragedies and disasters he's visited on his own people through his own feckless leadership, he certainly deserves to go. But I hope that, you know, if diplomacy doesn't do it, that eventually biology will. So sooner or later, he will pass from the scene. Although, you know, I don't know if you noticed, too, like he, Castro, Saddam, there must be like a dictator's diet. And they've all given up smoking. You know, they all eat yogurt and they all take long naps in the afternoon. And it's like these guys, they never, you know, I'm here watching my cholesterol and these guys like just go on and on. But anyways. Sooner or later,
I'll invite them on for a panel on the show.
That's right. Yeah. You know, the dictator's diet. I mean, like, what is it? You know, here's what I really believe. Yasser Arafat will not be replaced by an individual. I believe he'll be replaced by a coalition. He'll be replaced by a collective leadership. It may have some titular head, but one that I would hope would represent all the strands of Palestinian society and decision making. For instance, I would like to see Hamas in the Palestinian decision-making, you know, coalition. I would like to see, you know, Palestinian Islamic Jihad in there. I'd like to see the DFLP and the PFLP. I would like to see a Palestinian kind of collective decision-making body that together would be ultimately ready and willing, hopefully, to reach an agreement. See, one of the problems is about Arafat is that, you know, people say about Arafat, Palestinians can't have peace without him. With Israel, but they can't have democracy with him. And I don't even believe that's true. I think they can't have peace with him or democracy with him because as much authority as he has, he just doesn't seem ready or willing to make the big decision because he's afraid for his life. Well, if that's the case, then let's basically broaden the base of decision-making so that Palestinians can be in a position that if and when they take a decision, it will truly represent their entire collective.
Well, and that's why tell me more about why you'd want to include the jihadi groups, the groups who are responsible for the suicide bombers in this coalition.
Because I want everybody to be responsible for this decision. And or if they're not ready to be responsible, then I want them to have to be able to walk out on their entire community, not just on Yasser Arafat.
What do you think the odds of a coalition like this being established are?
I actually think they're quite high because I don't think there is any single individual, not only who stands out now as the natural successor to Arafat, but I think it's even more fundamental. I think nobody wants the job. I think nobody wants that kind of responsibility for having to sign off on a deal with Israel. And I think if it did come down to one person, that person would be more hardline than Yasser Arafat because no one is going to risk being exposed as giving away things Arafat, you know, wasn't ready to give away, and being Israel's boy or America's boy. And I don't think that's going to happen. And that's why, to me, the focus on Arafat coming or going is really the wrong issue. The focus has got to be on who can make the right decision. The right decision, of course, is a compromise, but a compromise that is fair to Palestinians and fair to Israelis at the same time, a compromise based on the 1967 boundaries. And, you know, I believe Arafat wasn't even up to that decision, and I would like to see a coalition that might be.
Now, what do you see in Israel as possible leaders after Sharon? How long do you estimate Sharon will stay in power?
I think it all depends on the Palestinians. Israelis, you know, have elected how many since Oslo? 5 different prime ministers, over the last decade. And what the Israeli public has shown is actually a very keen understanding of where the opportunities and dangers are. When they sense there are greater opportunities from the Arab side, that there was a real Arab partner, they brought you Yitzhak Rabin and Ehud Barak. When they sensed that the other side was off on a flight of fantasy, they brought you Bibi Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon. And so I believe that, you know, if you had a Palestinian leadership tomorrow that basically, you know, was able to persuade the Israeli center that, you know, they're ready for a real two-state solution that would end the conflict and would deal with the refugee issue in the context of refugees going back to the Palestinian state or compensation, that you'd get an Israeli majority tomorrow. I have no doubt about it. Terry, when 60% of Israelis, in the middle of this terrible situation, suicide bombings almost every day, when 60% of Israelis, 36% of Likud voters, of Sharon supporters, say that they would support the Saudi peace initiative, what does that tell you? What it tells you is that this war that we've just been through, and it has been a war. Okay, we've been through in the last 6 months the sixth Arab-Israeli war. And while this war doesn't have a name, it does have an aftermath. And the aftermath is having a huge effect, you can see, in Palestine among Palestinians and in Israel among Israelis. And what it's done in Israel is basically crushed the two ideas, the two big ideas that have dominated Israeli politics over the last 30 years. It has completely exploded the rights idea, the Jewish rights idea, that somehow Israel can retain the West Bank and Gaza, build all the settlements it wants, maintain a colonial occupation, seize Palestinian land all it wants, and the Palestinians will roll over for it. Well, guess what? That's a bunch of nonsense, and it's a bunch of hooey, and it's been exploded. Unfortunately, the left's argument that Yasser Arafat can and will be a responsible partner to build Palestinian institutions and a Palestinian civil society that can be the foundation of a two-state solution that would end the conflict has also been exploded. And so we've had the two big ideas that dominated Israeli politics all these years exploded. What's come in their place, though, Terry, is something very interesting. Instead of Israel being divided over two ideas, it's now united over two ideas. What I mean by that is Israelis are now, there is a solid majority, 60, 70, 80%, who are for crushing the Palestinians as long as they are out to just kill Israelis, which is what this suicide violence is all about. As long as that is the dominant thing coming out of Palestinians, suicide violence, then there is a huge majority in Israel for simply using whatever force necessary to put that down. At the same time, Israelis are also united the other way. There is a clear majority of Israelis who support the Saudi peace initiative now, or any peace initiative, if and when Palestinians demonstrate that they aren't out to destroy Israel, that they actually want a two-state solution and only a two-state solution. So I find Israeli politics very interesting now. Instead of being divided over two ideas, the public is actually united around these two ideas, and they will go whichever way the Palestinians lead them.
It's very difficult, I think, now for journalists to write about the Middle East. There are pressure groups on both sides that are accusing many journalists of not being fair, and it's a real minefield for journalists and for columnists to write about the Middle East without, you know, terrible accusations or even threatened boycotts headed in their direction. In fact, there's a boycott against the New York Times by Jewish readers who say that the New York Times coverage is unfair. Do those pressures come knocking at your door from either side?
Well, let me make a general point and then talk a little bit about myself. My general point is just what I learned in covering the Middle East now for virtually all my adult life, is that in the Middle East, everyone wants to own you as a reporter. And if they can't own you, they want to destroy you. There is no middle ground. No one puts their arm around you and says, geez, Terry, I really appreciated that fair, balanced report you did on my community. We really needed that criticism, and we're going to go home and think about it. That just doesn't happen. I understand why people are inflamed. This is the most polarizing moment I've ever been through in Middle East reporting. And it's a combination of post-9/11, of war after peace, of crushing disappointment on both sides. And there is real anger out there. And not only is there real anger, but there are much better tools out there, the internet for one, satellite TV for another, independent satellite TV, for people to communicate their anger directly to you and to one another. And so, you know, I don't want to sit here and defend every piece of journalism that's come out of the Middle East by the American media over the last, you know, 3 or 4 months. I'm sure mistakes have been made. But I think as a general matter, the press, whether it's the New York Times or the Washington Post or National Public Radio, and I'm a careful reader of all three, I think as a general matter, they've been trying to do a fair and decent job. It's not easy under these conditions. And all you have to do is read the Israeli press and see the searing criticism in Haaretz English edition of things going on in Israel and the West Bank. To know that the American press has been pretty much online. I think the European media has been much less responsible.
My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. Tomorrow he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. It's for his post-September 11th columns. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Friedman. He's a foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. Tomorrow, he receives his third Pulitzer Prize. It's for his post-September 11th columns. His previous two Pulitzers were for his reporting from the Middle East. He also won a National Book Award for his book From Beirut to Jerusalem. You are not only writing about one of the most divisive issues in the world. You're also Jewish, and you've been traveling a lot over the years through the Middle East and through the Arab world. And I'm wondering if you're sensing a rise in anti-Semitism in the places where you travel, where you've been traveling for many years.
There's no question that there is a rise of anti-Jewish feeling since 9/11 and this latest uprising in the territories. Unfortunately, Terry, what I found in the Arab Muslim world is that the issue of Israel, Jews, and America are all being wrapped up into one conspiratorial ball that is being blamed for a lot of ills, you know, by a lot of people in the Arab Muslim world. That's going on at the macro level. But I have to say, I've spent almost all my time since 9/11 traveling in the Muslim world. I've been received as warmly and respectfully for the most part, with a few exceptions, as I was before 9/11. You know, I went to Saudi Arabia, and I went to Saudi Arabia after having written a series of really harshly critical columns about Saudi Arabia and basically naming Saudi Arabia, I believe, as, you know, in large part responsible for the hijackers that produced 9/11. Here's the reaction I got when I got to Saudi Arabia, because my columns have all appeared there in Arabic in the Saudi press. Every column I've done since 9/11 was run in Sharq al-Awsat and read or certainly published in Saudi Arabia. Here's the reaction I got from Saudis who weren't sort of prepped ahead of time to be nice to me. Hi, I'm Tom Friedman. Tom Friedman, the one from the New York Times, the one who writes about us? Yeah. Yeah, that's me. You're here? Yeah, I'm here. They let you in? Yeah, yeah, they let me in. I'm not here illegally. They gave you a visa? Yeah, they gave me a visa. You know what? I hate everything you've written. Would you come to my house for dinner? I'd really like to get some people together to talk about it.
Really?
That was the universal reaction I got in Saudi Arabia. Real anger, but a real desire of people to explain themselves, explain their faith, which they believe was being misinterpreted and misconstrued, mm-hmm. And a real desire to be understood.
But I'm still wondering about anti-Semitism. When you're traveling through the Arab world and through the Middle East now, are you seeing new signs of anti-Semitism, new conspiracy theories, new publications of anti-Semitic tracts?
Well, the fact that the vicious canard that 4,000 Jews were somehow warned not to go to work in the World Trade Center on the morning of September 11th is still widely believed in the Muslim world today is, I think, a reflection of what's out there. I think that there is more anti-Semitism and more conspiratorial thinking about how kind of the Jews, the media, Israel, and America have all gotten together to, you know, blame the Arab Muslim world for 9/11 or to put that part of the world down. I have certainly found more of that out there today than ever before. It's very dangerous. It's very corrosive. It's corrosive for their societies because as long as you believe those things, you're never going to face your own problems. It's terribly dangerous and corrosive, I believe, for America and for Jews because a whole new generation will be suckled on it. And that's a whole new generation of young people who might one day volunteer for the next hijacking.
Well, Tom Friedman, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations again on your third Pulitzer Prize.
It's great, Terry. It's great to talk to you. I just want to say one last thing.
Go ahead.
Which is that it goes back to your journalism point. You know, this has been the most important story for my generation of journalists. This is our Watergate, in a way. The thing that has struck me about why I think the quality of the journalism during this period, for the most part, dealing with the whole post 9/11 world, has been so good is that I think people really understand, I certainly understand, and I think many of my colleagues do, that this is about our kids. This is about the world that our kids are going to grow up in. And we really better get it right. And that, I think, certainly motivates me, and I think it motivates a lot of my colleagues as well.
Tom Friedman receives his third Pulitzer Prize tomorrow at a luncheon on the Columbia University campus. It's for his post-September 11th columns. His post-9/11 columns will be published this summer in a new book called Longitudes and Attitudes that will also include journals of his travels around the world. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Moon Women by Pamela Duncan, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two views on celibacy and the priesthood. Father James Martin tells us about leaving the corporate world to take his vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And Eugene Kennedy tells us why he left the priesthood to marry. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.